There's a sign at the entrance of a remote roadhouse in Wyoming, and it reads this way: if you find the stakes here tough, then please leave quietly. This is no place for weaklings. The world of 1965 is a tough place, and it is no place for weaklings either. I do not say the world into which you are going, because you are already in it. And life in teen and college years is tough, just as life that you face. And it's just as tough and demanding in its own way as any of the situations of life which you move toward today. Yet so was the world of 1930 and 1940 and 1900 and 1860. Living has always been tough, and so it will remain. Frankly, the world in which we live is a tough place, and only those who go forthrightly into the arena with some direction and assert themselves are going to make much of our world or of themselves. We pretty well recognize now that there's not going to be a golden age on our earth. The world will never be made safe for democracy. There will never be complete freedom from poverty and want and pain. The story of history is that when man finds an answer to one of his challenges, he immediately creates another. This is a fact of history and of our world. Still, this does not in any way say that the world is bad. Our world is pretty much what we make it, and to what we commit ourselves. There are large segments of our population today that are uncommitted. They are not concerned. They are not concerned with what goes on in other nations of the world, or really what goes on in our nation or in our government, or in our state, or in our city, or even in our own neighborhood, except where activity in these spheres specifically affects their own material welfare directly. If the threat is to my way of life, the tax directly on me, or the benefit directly to me, yes, okay. But otherwise, I won't get involved. We only get involved when we feel personally threatened. I remember several years ago, I was invited to a home in a rather remote area in Alaska to dinner. This was a simple family. They didn't have very much of this world's goods. And obviously, when I got there, they'd had to scrap around a little bit to find plates and cups and saucers and utensils sufficient for me and for the large family of husband and wife and children. But it was clean, pleasant. This family had a little dog. And when I went into the house, I made friends with the dog. He was a very friendly dog. He lapped around and tried to get in my lap, which didn't please me too much, but I was friendly with him just the same, and we seemed to have been great friends. Then I sat down to eat. And after we had the blessing, this dog began to growl and began to pull at my pants legs, and very antagonistic. And I couldn't figure what was the matter, because I thought this dog and I were friends. Finally, I said to the little 7-year-old boy sitting next to me, I said, "Charlie, I don't think your dog likes me very much." And he looked up at me and he said, "Oh, yes, Bishop, he likes you okay. It's only you're eating out of his plate." Well, I think maybe you get what I mean. That we are concerned, we are involved violently and precipitously when we are threatened ourselves, but mighty little when the threat is to somebody else. There's no place for the uncommitted in our world today. The man that lives to himself will die by himself. The city that lives to itself will die by itself. The university that lives to itself will die by itself. The state that lives to itself will die by itself. And the nation which lives to itself will die by itself. Real life today has no place for the uncommitted jellyfish drifting in the stream of time, not particularly liking what's going on, criticizing a little bit maybe, but not really taking a stand. Yet how do we know that our governor is right? Some of you probably think he isn't. How do we know that our legislature or our Congress or our president? We criticize, but what do we do about it? Do we honestly seek to find the answers and then take a stand? Yes, we don't want to be, we really don't want to get involved. And we feel insecure and uninformed and fearful of being conspicuous and almighty afraid of being wrong, of being ridiculed. And so we are uncommitted. It's entirely possible, indeed very probable, that a dedicated communist with a living, passionate, even though mistaken, concern for others is nearer to God's plan for life in our day than as a lukewarm supporter of democracy or of the Christian church who drifts along on a self-satisfied bed of ease with personal pleasure and concern his prime motivation. It's better to take a stand honestly and sincerely when you are wrong than to drift with the current as driftwood in the cause of right. So the honest seeker is called to conviction and decisive action in our troubled times. We cannot live only in the objective world we think of things we know and can be sure of. We experience life in two quite different ways. I experience the world as a world of objects, open to my observation. This is the world with which science is concerned. But I also experience life as an inner awareness of being alive. The crucial point is that the self which knows and decides stands entirely outside the objective world. So there is an increasing realization that life cannot be lived without making decisions. The stream of life which bears us along will not stay until knowledge is complete. We have to act on such knowledge as we have. Neither nature nor history can tell us what we ought to do. We have to make up our own minds, accept our responsibility, make our venture, and take the risks. After we have got all the light we can from experimental science, we have each of us to decide to which way of life we shall commit ourselves. If we are not to drift aimlessly, we have to choose our pattern of life and live in accordance with it. Subjection to the demands of the material world may make slaves of us all and of our world. There are some things in life, and they may be the most important things, that we cannot know by research or reflection, but only by committing ourselves. We may find ourselves confronted with a demand about which we know that if we respond to it, the gates of life remain open to us, while if we refuse it, we shall be condemned henceforth to live on a lower level. To live means that we are not merely observers, investigators, technicians, but that at times we have to stake our whole existence. And it's only by making these great and daring commitments that we can experience and know what life really is. So how can we be sure? Sure enough to commit ourselves in the complex universe in which we reside. Because the implication is that if we cannot be sure, then we must not act. That is a disease of our time, that if we are unsure, we must not do anything. Yet you are to determine what you must do in any given situation. And you can almost never be sure that you are right. But you must almost always act anyway. The desire to be sure is essentially a desire to be safe from error and its consequences. But it is completely unrealistic. Safety and certainty are luxuries we don't have in this world. And we have to learn to live and to choose and to decide and to act without them. We are called in our time to a commitment, to take a stand in the arena of living events, to come to decisions about what is right and good, and to stand there for what we believe. How often do we hear, "That's not my affair. Let somebody else do it. There's nothing I can do about it. What can one person do?" Thus, there is a tendency to drift, to let others carry us along the stream of living action, making us parasites on the thinking and actions of others. We come back constantly to the probing question, how can I know what is right? What action to take? Where to stand? In the field of human events, there's too much knowledge for one mind to grasp. And the complexities of living preclude definitive knowledge in most aspects of life. We can't know all the answers. To illustrate the problem of discerning what is right, if you go to Washington, D.C., and stand in the middle of the Memorial Bridge over the Potomac, looking north, you will have in plain sight on your right the Lincoln Memorial, and on your left the Arlington home of Robert E. Lee. Here are monuments to two of our nation's most revered heroes. Good, courageous, and devout men, both of them. And yet they fought on opposite sides in a bloody civil war. Now I am convinced that each of these men followed the guidance of God to the best of his ability. Both of them were far from sure of the objective righteousness of their cause. This is clearly revealed in their writings. But they did not allow their uncertainty to immobilize them. They chose the best they could and acted. And they were right in doing so, both of them. They took the only honorable course, both of them. You see, there are two kinds of right and wrong. Objectively, only one of these men could be right. But subjectively, both of them were right if they courageously followed the right as they saw it. And this is what we've got to recognize, that we may never know with certainty whether a course is right or wrong objectively, for that may require a superhuman knowledge more than we will ever have. But we can know the right subjectively, most of the time, because that is simply a matter of following what you honestly think is right. And this is what God asks of you, that you be subjectively righteous, for that is within your power. When your conscience makes a moral decision for you, it is wrong for you to follow the lesser path, and it is wrong for you to stand aside, uncommitted and undetached. The only right course is to follow the best you know, regardless of doubts, uncertainties, and moral ambiguities. In this finite existence, alternatives are never clear-cut and pure. But for us, the difference between the lesser and the greater evils must be seen as a difference between right and wrong. So, being true to ourselves and committed to a positive and courageous course, we do not have to be objectively right, although we have to try to be. By chance, I happened to be in Birmingham, Alabama, March 8th to the 13th, during the time of the greatest crisis in Selma. During these days, men and women were faced with a challenge of commitment as never before in their lives, and at some great cost. a great many people in Alabama were uncommitted. Most of the Negro people of Birmingham went along with the life as usual, on the fringe of a turmoil that must change their lives for good or evil. They didn't want to get involved, because unquestionably, present involvement would be at some real cost to themselves, physically, economically. So let somebody else do it. Some were involved to the hilt, and at great cost to themselves, both physically and economically. Many people that I met among the white population also wanted to do something. But what can one person do? I'll be standing alone. So very few did anything, except they suffered from an inward guilt that was salved by the absolution of, I can't do it alone. And yet you and I know deep down that there always has to be a beginning. Somebody has to begin. Somebody has to stand out. And that may well be you, or it may well be me. Many white people actively opposed the marches, the demonstrations, and all that they stood for. And they opposed these many times violently and angrily. These were the threatened ones, now involved because in their eyes they stood to lose something that was theirs by right, something that provided personal comfort and material ease. They were involved, and they were involved for the wrong reasons. Other whites stood in opposition, a few, because they honestly believed that the present consequences were wrong, that the total impact now on the whole South would be wrong for both Negro and white. They committed themselves honestly and courageously, and I believe that they were gloriously wrong, those few who from honest and unselfish motives stood battling a lost cause. There were others who came to march, many sincerely and humbly, and yet filled with questioning about the complete rightness of what they were doing. The possibility of violence, going against a federal injunction, the fear that they were somehow salving their conscience by a grandstand witness for racial brotherhood that would forever be a comfortable pillar on which a concern for fellow men might be rested. Yet these persons chose honestly what they thought was right. And they were right, and they were committed. There were others in the march for wrong reasons. Excitement, thrill, a once-in-a-lifetime stand. There were the professional beginners. And I believe that they were wrong. Maybe in the right place for the wrong reason, as were my occasional white Southern friends who stood for wrong for the right reason. How do we know? How do we know? There's a form of religion, and it's not necessarily Christian, which seeks to provide an escape from this uncertainty, and which is therefore very appealing. But we must resist this with all of our power as a satanic temptation. This is legalism, the laying down of absolute laws that must never be broken under any circumstances. God did not design his world this way. Some people like that kind of authority. It relieves them of moral responsibility. It seems to offer safety from error, to promise that you serve and please God by following a set of rules. Our commitment cannot be to that sort of religion by law. Life is not a set of fixed and frozen situations etched in black and white. It is a dynamic, living, and changing thing where good and evil are all mixed up, and where God is there in the midst of it, working with the evil as well as the good. Men must at times kill in order to save, and to punish in order to love, and to hurt in order to heal, and to struggle in order to bring peace. We live by faith under the immediate judgment of a graceful and forgiving God, not by laws and regulations. And God judges us not by law, nor by our success in being objectively right, but by our intentions, whether they are honest and unselfish, true, good, and courageous. That is what it means to be justified by faith. It means being right with God in your heart. That sounds awfully dangerous, doesn't it? It is. It's very, very dangerous. But it's life. It can be distorted and abused. Even by well-meaning people, it can be the cause of great and costly mistakes. But it is life and the answer to life, and it's ours to take or reject. All this talk of goodness and right and unselfishness and truth has little meaning unless there is good in the world and a good purpose and a direction behind it. I believe that there is, and that from this purpose and motivation comes the only justification for our commitment. And with commitment comes direction and life. I quote from the recently published diary of Dag Hammarskjöld called Markings. I don't know who or what put the question. I don't know when it was put. I don't even remember answering. But at some point I did answer yes to someone or to something, and from that hour I was certain that existence was meaningful, and that therefore my life in self-surrender has a goal. From that moment I have known what it means not to look back and to take no thought for the morrow. Sure, our times are tough, and so is our world, and so are we. Surely, though, nowhere near so tough as the world faced by King George VI on January 1, 1940, when Britain was fighting for her life and few had hope. I close with the words that King George used in ending his broadcast to the people of England on that historic and testing day. I said to the man who stood at the gate of the year, "Give me a light that I may tread safely into the unknown." And he replied, "Go out into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. That shall be to you better than light and safer than a known way."